The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is Monday, February 3rd, 2014, and tonight is our all-host group show. Finally, after a long wait since the last time we got together. And tonight we have more people than ever. Tonight, four of us are here, so it should be interesting. I will introduce each one individually and alphabetically. So first up is me, Carolyn. Hello there, everyone. And then Hadding Scott.
Good evening.
Paul Hickman.
Hi.
Paul, speak up, Paul.
Hi, good evening.
Yes, Paul is has the show voice of Albion. And Tan Stoffels.
Hello.
Yes, who has Age of Treason. And Hadding Scott is co-host of The International Jew, for anybody who's not up on all of that. Well, I'm very glad to have you here, gentlemen, because it makes for an easy show for me, which I like, and I'm going to try to not talk as much as I'm used to talking all the time, see, as soon as I get on the air, so I have to watch that. But I think to start out, I would just like to bring up that the White Network, we need to talk a little bit about the White Network, because the White Network is doing very well, in my opinion. People have been pointing out to me our Alexa ranking, and I'm a little bit leery about Alexa rankings, but I shouldn't be, because we just got up some new server stats today on the White Network, and it shows exactly the same thing, that we're doing extremely well as far as visitors to our website. So isn't that right, Tan?
Yeah, it shows a steady ramping up of traffic over the last year or so.
Well, it shows that in January, this past January, just ended a couple few days ago, we had 20,500 unique visitors, and that's a lot to me. I mean, that doesn't make us, of course, anything like number one or something, but it's a very, very respectable amount of visitors. And then we had 221,500 pages viewed in January, and this goes along with our Alexa ranking. And I did look some things up today, and I don't know if it, I hope this doesn't, anybody wants to, add anything while I'm going over this, but I'm not trying to, I'm not using these comparisons for any particular reason, except that they're also radio networks. So I just wanted to point out that the White Network had an Alexa ranking of 290,000 today. It has been lower than that. The lower, the better, see, global ranking, but it's up a little. It's not as quite as good as it was in the 260s a while back, but it shifts around, and 22,700 in the United Kingdom. But the average time on the site shows at 6 minutes, 6.5 minutes, and pages per view show at 4.4 pages looked at for each person that gets on. There. And then I looked at the Ugly Truth .wordpress.com, and they have a better ranking, but not that much better. And they've been for a long time a very, very popular network, and they have also lots of news, a lot of blog posts, or news posts and so on, lots of things on there to look at, and which we don't have. I wish we did have a little more blogs at the White Network, but they have 266,500 to our 290, and they have a good U.S. ranking, but they're, hope this is not boring you. The minutes, time on the site is 3 minutes to our almost 6.5 minutes, so half of that, and the pages are like almost two pages per view, and ours is 4.4. So people are not spending as much time, each person is not spending, at least according to Alexa. And So Republic Broadcasting, which I've always seen as, you know, really big, and of course they have tons of hosts and all kinds of posts about the news and so on, and lots of things going on there, something 24 hours a day just about. And their global ranking was 264, well, almost, let's say, close to 265,000. So that's a little better than the Ugly Truth, not much, and better than us, but not all that much either. And they have a little better U.S. ranking than the Ugly Truth. And average time on the site there was 3 minutes, a little over 3 minutes, and 2.5 pages, better than the Ugly Truth, but not as good as White Network.
Carolyn?
Yes, yes.
With that, the amount of time spent, it might be that they're coming onto the site, having a quick read of the description, and then clicking download, and then leaving the site?
Well, I don't know what the reason is, but they have things to read at Republic and at Ugly Truth, and we have our comments. I think, you know, people go to the comments, but they have comments too, and a lot of comments. Well, not Republic. I don't know what it is. See, I'm just going over this real quick just to set the tone, just to say that I would say that we are really in the running here, and that never was really our intention, you know, when Tan and I started this, to compete with anybody or try to be, you know, that popular or anything. We had our ideas about what we wanted to be, and but we have become, I think, quite well known and quite well liked. So any comments on that? Besides what
I think it's a natural consequence of just longevity, being around for a longer and longer time. You establish more and more links, you become better known. As you commented on Saturday, there are people who are still unaware and discovering what it is that is being said on this network, and it's something that they like and that they are ready to hear, but they haven't heard it yet. So, and I'm sure that there are more people out there in the same situation that we could stand to promote more.
Republic Broadcasting has been around for ages, and I'm surprised they're not better than that. But you can't get that much better. You know, if you get down to 100,000. You're really in global. You're really in the top rank. I think Daily Stormer has gotten down to 56,000, which is fantastic. And you have like Stormfront and things. You know, I think are better than that. But that's
46. The Daily Stormer's at now 46,000.
Oh wow! It just keeps.
Yeah.
It keeps moving down. I mean, it's a phenomenon. All right. So, and it doesn't hurt that our programs are reposted on the Daily Stormer, that's for sure. And they're also reposted on Grism, which we get quite a few hits from there. So we do appreciate that. That does help
I like
us
Grism.
Have the ranking we have, I guess.
I like Grism.
Do you?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm not going to. I look to see what's on there, but most of it I think, what is this? Anyway, so that's what I have to say about that. Anybody want to say anything more about our little network here?
Well, I'm very pleased. I'm pleased with the quality. I'm glad that we've added Paul, that Paul has joined us just recently, and I'm very happy with that, and I hope we continue down that road.
Thanks, Tan. I'd say that because I tried to use before Blog Talk Radio, and there's constant audio problems, and I've listened to other shows on there, and they've had sort of, you know, perpetual audio problems, and with the White Network, we don't seem to have this problem, so maybe that helps a lot as well. People know that if they come along and listen to some podcasts on the White Network, they're not going to have that, you know, constant, you know, audio problems and stuff like that. So it's quite smooth, I'd say.
Well, I think our audio quality is very good. And I have heard sometimes, not, you know,
other shows having problems with it. I don't know why they do or what's going on sometimes the way they're connected or something, but we do have generally excellent audio quality. The only problem is if an individual's like, say for me, if my Skype connection is not good and I don't want to shut down and start it all up again, then sometimes there can be a little distortion. But generally we've been, and Tan says he thinks we're just lucky that we don't have more problems with Skype than we do.
Yes, more network problems. I was really talking about the content quality, not so much the audio quality.
Oh, I know you were.
But, yeah, as far as connection issues and technical problems, not to, I don't know. I think a lot of times when people claim they're having technical problems, Paul is giving his honest opinion, I think, of his experience in the past with other systems. But a lot of times I suspect when other people say, oh, well, we couldn't do the show this week because of technical issues, that it's maybe at least some of the time that they really didn't have a show to do. And so they blame technical issues. People like to blame the computer for their problems. And as we see, the system, it's okay. The internet sticks together most of the time.
Right. Okay. Well, I started out with something that I wanted to talk about, and I've got a little thing here about economics, but I just assume someone else introduce something that you want to bring up that maybe you're what you think would be good to open with.
Well, were you thinking of Jonathan Pollard? Is that the thing?
That's
the first thing you told me about.
That.
Well, I thought that was a great one. Just as an introduction, I could say that the Pollard thing ties into the ADL and ties into Leo Frank, and it ties into the whole conversation for the next 2 hours probably could be all linked together with that. But, the story that you told, that you linked to me was about Jonathan Pollard, the perennial push by the Jews to get Pollard freed from prison, mm-hmm. and how the most recent push involves Abraham Foxman at the ADL saying that it's borderline anti-Semitism.
Right.
It's, that he's still in prison, and that only a vendetta could be behind this, and it's not just this vendetta against this one individual spy who's in prison. It's a vendetta against the whole Jewish people.
really, it's so amazing how they can, But the whole thing is that the anti-Semitism is the thing they're pushing now. And you have to say it's the international Jewish agenda. Because it's coming from everywhere. And it's everything is now all about, maybe it has been for as long as this, but it seems like it's popping up more than really strongly lately. And, of course, they're saying that Israel, criticizing Israel is the new anti-Semitism. I've talked about that on several shows in various ways and just real recently, too. But he says, Foxman says that... calling for Pollard's parole on humanitarian grounds, said that Pollard's continued imprisonment was an effort to intimidate American Jews.
Yeah.
Based on an anti-Semitic stereotype about the Jewish community that American Jews are more loyal to Israel than to their own country, and of course it's been shown to be true.
Well, Pollard certainly was.
Yeah.
Pollard certainly was. There was a lot of this problem in the Reagan administration with Zionist Jews that had been brought on board as, alleged conservatives whose loyalty was more to the State of Israel than to the United States. They really sabotaged his foreign policy, his attempt to be even-handed and be friendly with Arab states. And, this is sort of an extreme expression of that undermining tendency, where they think they know better than the president and everybody else. But I got the affidavit that the defense secretary Caspar Weinberger sent to the court, And this is what Weinberger said. Of course, Weinberger was a Jew.
And Patty, you could get a little bit further away from your mic, I think.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Well, I have the affidavit that Caspar Weinberger submitted to the court regarding the Pollard case. And he said, "The defendant has substantially harmed the United States, and in my view, his crimes demand severe punishment. Because it may not be clear to the court that the defendant's activities have caused damage of the magnitude realized, I felt it necessary to provide an informed analysis to the court so that an appropriate sentence could be fashioned. My foregoing comments will, I hope, dispel any presumption that disclosures to an ally are insignificant. To the contrary, substantial and irrevocable damage has been done to this nation. Punishment, of course, must be appropriate to the crime, and in my opinion, no crime is more deserving of severe punishment than conducting espionage activities against one's own country. This is especially true when the individual spy has voluntarily assumed the responsibility of protecting the nation's secrets." So there's Caspar Weinberger, a Jew, saying you must throw the book at Jonathan Pollard. And yeah. The quantity of documents that Pollard had turned over to the Israelis was in terms of paper printouts, it was 360 cubic feet of documents.
Wow.
Haddon, can I just mention something? Because, you know, you mentioned Reagan there. I'd never actually heard of Pollard until recently, but I looked up a few things, and I don't know if you've heard of this, but apparently in 1983, Ronald Reagan signed the executive agreement with Israel in which Israel and the United States agreed to share intelligence that was vital to each other's security. Have you heard of that before?
I may have, but I don't recall it.
It sounds like, in a way, you know, America with their sort of bowing down to Israel are kind of asking for it in a lot of ways. And if I could read a couple of paragraphs, short paragraphs, what I read off a website called What Really Happened. The title is More Holes in U.S. Electronic Security. And it says, the story on Israel spying inside focused on three companies. Amdocs, which provides billing and directory assistance for most American phone companies. Comverse Infosys, which installs and maintains telephone tapping equipment for U.S. law enforcement. And Odigo, which provides services for the various instant message systems on your computer. All three companies are owned by Israel and have strong ties to the Israeli Defense Force. Both Amdocs and Comverse Infosys were implicated in the sale of telephone data which compromised U.S. investigations into drug running, and Comverse Infosys phone taps are suspected of being the means by which Bill Clinton's phone sex sessions were recorded, as reported in the Ken Starr report. Odigo, which had offices near the World Trade Towers, is the company which received a two-hour advance warning of the attacks of 9/11. Now, in a chilling real-life version of the plotline from the net, it turns out that the majority of the firewalls of U.S. corporate and government computer systems are provided by just one company, Checkpoint Systems, which, like Amdocs, Comverse Infosys and Odigo, is headquartered in Israel. So if they try and say, you know, people are being anti-Semitic or conspiracy theorists about Israel knowing all this kind of private information from the U.S., well, it's all true.
That's right. That's right. The big point is that it's all true, and it's time that Americans of all persuasions, well, if you're real, see, it's political. If it's a political thing, but it should be that all Americans should be able to say, you know, this is true about you Jews, and we're not going to tolerate it anymore.
Yeah. Well, it's a defense mechanism that the Jews use to, they're very sensitive, of course, to the harm that they're doing. And in order to head off criticism of that harm, they flip it around and blame others for harming them. And this is the mechanism that recurs over and over and over again. And in fact, it's so reliable. I would say that even when you hear the Jews squawking about somebody harming them, you can be sure that behind that story is a story of one or more Jews harming other people. And the louder the squawking about how they're being harmed, the greater the harm it is that they're doing to others. The Pollard case is a good example where the complaining that they're doing about the injustice done not just to Pollard but to Jews as a whole is a cover for the NSA scandal and the Amdocs thing, this, all of this stuff that's related to it. The fact that the Jews have their hooks into the government and are doing things that are harming the hosts that they're parasitizing.
But it's like it's treason of the U.S. government to let them do this. I mean, how can they not be able to do their own sort of telephone algorithms and data mining? Why would you dole out such an important thing to a foreign company, Amdocs?
Because not do it would be anti-Semitic, and this is this goes all the way back to what's his name. Rockwell referred to him.
President?
No, the senator, Senator McCarthy. It goes back to McCarthy and beyond. But you can see back in the 50s when McCarthy was investigating communists that it was really Jews that were infiltrating and had infiltrated the U.S. government already by that point. And even then, people were trying to be patriotic Americans in this instinct of, well, you can't do that, that's treason to the United States, was stronger than it is today. But even so, it still didn't prevail, even in the 1950s. His efforts, McCarthy's, was ultimately thwarted. And it's just been downhill since then. Today, it's treason to Israel is worse than treason to America. It's, you know, the interests of Israel and the interests of Jews trump the interests of Americans. We saw that a year ago in the nomination of process of the defense, the Secretary of Defense of the United States had to be vetted basically by Jews that he was going to be okay for the Jews and that he was going to be good for Israel. And the consideration of whether he was going to be a good Secretary of Defense and uphold put the interests of the United States first was a secondary consideration.
Well, I think that we need to say, I mean, this is clearly, they call it anti-Semitism, but what it really is that Jews are in control, pro-Israel Jews too, because what other kind of Jew is there, in control of the United States government, on all branches and everywhere. And that's a fact. And we still want to say, well, we need to stop this encroachment of Jews, or we need to do this or that. They're already in charge. Wouldn't they have to be, or this couldn't be going on. What Paul is bringing up, like how can all that be, headquartered in Israel, all that sensitive stuff? Well, I don't know. What other answer is there? Anyone?
Well, I don't think any of the hosts here really argues against that.
No, but how do we say that, to the people? How do we say that to people? I think we need to start changing our language. Just when we say, well, the Jews are in control of everything, people say, don't be so kooky. Don't be so crazy. The Jews aren't in charge of everything. Well, they seem to be.
Well, I'd never heard of Amdocs before until I started looking at it today. Tan mentioned it. I mean, is it general knowledge? I'm guessing it's not, that Amdocs have this so much power over sort of electronic communications.
It's not general knowledge, no.
Well, that's the only answer I would think, that with the kind of reach that our side has, which is limited but still it's something.
Well, you know, it could be known, Paul. The reason it's not well known is because people aren't interested in learning about things like this. People are being distracted by entertainment of various kinds and scandals and this and that and so on, and shock things and so on. So if they're not looking at boring stuff like Amdocs and U.S. communications.
Mm-hmm. But this is the thing, because people think if they're on Skype or something and they send a PM means a private message, but it's not at all private, is it? I think people would kind of be angry. Well, some people might be angry if they knew, you know, the extent to what it goes to.
You know, I think the attitude generally is, yeah, we know that they know everything, but since they know everything already, there's no point in trying to stop it. So what can they do anyway? I'm not doing that much, so I don't care. I mean, it's not that they don't care, but, you know, it doesn't seem to be an issue that anybody's going to get carried away about. You know, it's going to get up in arms about, even though we know it.
The whole NSA thing seems to be getting some sort of traction, a little bit.
Well, and then now they're saying that this guy, the latest, it seems to me that I noticed, is that Snowden is an agent for, government agent for Obama. What's that? Do you think so? Anybody?
I don't know.
Well, yeah, I don't know what to think of Snowden.
Well, I don't either. So, you know, I'm so busy with the way of looking at it that Tan expressed so well that I don't really get into these issues in the sense of understanding how our community, you know, UN security communications and so on work. And I don't feel that I'm knowledgeable in those technical issues, and most people don't.
Yeah.
So most people don't even get in, you know, don't even read that stuff.
Well, I suppose the thing is, people aren't stupid. They know that the internet is not really private, but I think they would think that their own government will look at it and have access to the information. But it might be a shock to realize that it's a foreign government that has access to the information. I suppose that would be the point to kind of stress to people.
Well, this has been brought out at times. It's brought out regularly. But like I say, it doesn't get the attention of the mass of people, like scandals like, I was just trying to think of his name. What's our little friend here? Woody Allen do?
Well, you know, that as Amdocs, that was discussed in the famous Fox News series on Israeli spying back from 2002 with Carl Cameron and Britt Hume. They did talk about Amdocs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they did.
Okay. But, and yet, you know, it just continues on the same, doesn't it?
Here's Carl Cameron from that documentary. Here's how the system works. Most directory assistance calls and virtually all call records and billing in the U.S. are done for the phone companies by Amdocs Limited, an Israeli-based private telecommunications company. Amdocs has contracts with the 25 biggest phone companies in America and more worldwide. The White House and other secure government phone lines are protected, but it is virtually impossible to make a call on normal phones without generating an Amdocs record of it. In recent years, the FBI and other government agencies have investigated Amdocs more than once. The firm has repeatedly and adamantly denied any security breaches or wrongdoing. But sources tell Fox News that in 1999, the super-secret National Security Agency, headquartered in Northern Maryland, issued what's called a top-secret Sensitive Compartmentalized Information Report, TS/SCI, warning that records of calls in the United States were getting into foreign hands, in Israel in particular.
Well, then, from all of this that's been said here, what would you say, what would you have to say as to who is the overall big decider of what goes on in the world? Or just, let's say, what goes on in the United States with all of our wealth that we don't really have, and, you know, all of our resources and so on, and our military. And so who is in control? Who is in control based on all of this stuff we've just been talking about.
I think the Jews are in control. It's pretty clear. But that the control is not so much that it comes to a single point, a single decider who decides on issues. I think it has to do with moral legitimacy, that it has to do with the fact that Jews think of themselves as a legitimate people with legitimate concerns, and nobody else's concerns override theirs. That is the how each individual Jew thinks, and that produces this sort of emergent property of Jews swarming and stomping on anyone who stands in their way. And it's also, on the converse side, why white people are on the run. We don't feel morally legitimate to speak on our own behalf for our own interests. We may have some courage to stand up as an American. I think that this is just outrageous that our national security information is shared with Israel. But that is very quickly stomped on and squashed by the minute somebody starts whispering that, oh, well, I think we've got an anti-Semite here. And the person starts to realize that they might lose their job, that they're very likely going to lose their job. And that, you know, you pointed to one cause of people not getting involved or not being all that interested in this, which is apathy, Carolyn. But I think another big contributor is pain. It's people are well aware, and it's almost like Pavlov's dogs. They know when the Jews start getting in a emitting certain signals, that the very next thing that's going to follow is the hammer coming down on somebody. And we see that over and over again. The other issue that I hope we could discuss tonight is Tom Perkins, because that's an abject example of what I'm talking about, of how these people, it's almost like whack-a-mole. You know, every so often somebody gets uppity, stands up, and in this case they're not even really consciously uppity. They just say something a little bit without thinking too deeply about whose toes they might be stepping on. And in this case, they step on Jews' toes, and the Jews stomp on them. And after a while, human beings are pretty good at pattern recognition, even if doing it subconsciously. They recognize that saying words like Kristallnacht or saying words like Holocaust are going to get them stomped on. Saying words like Israel, saying, even when it comes to, you know, they try to work up the courage of this, I'm an American and I'm a loyal, patriotic American, and I think this is just outrageous that information is being shared with Israel. That might be their first thought, but it's overridden ultimately by this realization that there's going to be this pain coming down on their heads, and nobody is going to stand with them and help them.
But, you know, let me just interject here, Tan, that, you know, the overriding question is still for me, why are Jews capable of causing this kind of pain and nobody else is?
Because,
you know,
they work together. Other people are.
Okay.
To the extent that they can latch on to a bigger group identity and a moral legitimacy, they are capable of fighting the Jews or fighting at the same level. It's a group legitimacy. It's group identity. Any group is stronger than any individual.
That's true.
And that's really what's at the root of what's going on. The Jews have kicked the shit out of everybody else. They've got white people scattered and operating as individuals now, or at best as weak Americans. And that trumps anybody who tries to stand in their way, because they immediately swarm. They come out as a whole group. And it's not because they all are secretly communicating via some top secret. They have plenty of channels that they communicate with themselves. But
somebody's messing around with their headset, I think. And I don't think whoever it is, they don't realize how much noise it makes. It makes a lot of noise. So please don't do that. Okay.
My point is that they do communicate, but it's not that there's a single brain making a decision. That it's a bunch of, as we see in the Tom Perkins example, it's a bunch of individual Jews who are operating by the same set of simple rules in their mind. That I'm a Jew, I'm entitled to stand up for Jewish interests, and I'm going to speak my mind no matter who it is that I have to attack, and that's why a swarm of them will come out in cases like Tom Perkins to do just that. Or in the case of Pollard, that every so often there's this, it's almost like locusts. Every 17 years, the locusts come out and swarm. Well, every 6 months or every 12 months, they come out and they Jews swarm in favor of Pollard, that they've got. And if there's a something in the news about the Jews doing something wrong when it comes to spying or information, the NSA thing, whatever, then they'll harp on Pollard to distract attention away from that. They do a similar thing with the Holocaust. Anytime the Israelis are stomping on Palestinian heads, there are other Jews that come forward and start hyping on the Holocaust. Is that you, Paul?
No, that's Padding messing around in his chair. Squeaky chair. You know, Tan, I wish you would talk about this Tom Perkins thing.
All right. Well, for people who don't know, it's fallen off of the news now. But last week, and maybe the week before that, it was a big item. It was a letter to the editor from Tom Perkins, who is the Kleiner Perkins, whatever, some venture capitalist, big venture capitalist firm that he was one of the founders of in Silicon Valley.
So, Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield and Byers.
That's right. And he's retired now, and he's not all that rich either. I mean, I thought he was a billionaire, a mega billionaire, but he's not even on the Forbes 400. But he's wealthy. He's independently wealthy. Doesn't really have to care what other people have to say about him because he's so wealthy. Well, he wrote a very brief letter to the editor of the Wall Street Journal. And in after the firestorm that it touched off, the Wall Street Journal said it was the most read letter to the editor ever in the history of the Wall Street Journal. What he said was, the main point that he made was that he thought that the rhetoric coming from the left about the 1%, meaning the rich, the wealthy 1% that controls the economy and controls the media and so forth, controls the government, that their rhetoric was, he saw a parallel there with Kristallnacht and the Jews in Germany. And that was the illusion that he used. And the Jews went berserk. And the main point that they made was that Perkins was wrong to make any sort of comparison at all between the merely rich and the Jews, that there is no comparison there. And this goes to the point I'm talking about moral legitimacy. A lot of what the Jews had to say in criticism of Perkins could as equally be applied to the Jews as it is the rich. They were writing things about the rich. The rich are detached from reality. The rich are paranoid. They were laughing and mocking Perkins. But much of what they said, you could just have substituted instead of the rich, you could have substituted the Jews in there, and it would have fit. But the Jews that were writing these opinions, that were stomping on Perkins's head, were not even conscious of that. They just were saying these things because they were so unselfconscious about the position that the Jews have. And their main point was, how dare you compare the rich to the Jews? Mm-hmm. It's immoral, basically.
Well, it's really a very obvious comparison. You know, Brooks Adams, The Law of Civilization and Decay, it pretty much presents plutocracy as a tendency that paves for Jewish power. In the last chapter of The Law of Civilization and Decay, after talking about plutocracy in the Roman Empire and in Britain, the last chapter he talks about Rothschild, right? Because that's where it leads to. The Jew is economic man par excellence. And so there is a connection there. It's an inherent connection.
Yeah, of course there is.
Between plutocracy and Jewish power. It's not just that the Jews have a lot of money either. You'll get the same kinds of arguments, and I'm involved in these arguments daily, against complaining against Jews and complaining against free trade and things like this. You'll be told that you know it's your fault that you're not a success. You're just jealous. You should work harder to be successful. and, you know, rather than the idea that the government has some kind of role to play in rectifying a situation and not letting a minority of people take advantage of situations at the expense of the majority, which is what goes on. It's the same thing with the rich that are profiting from things like free trade, and with Jews. They're both parasites doing well at the expense of society as a whole.
Yeah.
And they use the same kinds of arguments in defense.
Perkins' point was that he saw the parallel. He heard the Jewish narrative about Kristallnacht and about the Holocaust, and what it boiled down to for him, the way he generalized it, was that a minority needs to be protected, especially a wealthy minority, from the majority, who is going to be resentful and get their pitchforks out and unfairly resent that wealthy minority. And that was the analogy and he stuck with that too. When he went on to apologize, he apologized for using the word Kristallnacht, but he said he stood by this principle that he was trying to expound. And what he didn't get is that the Jews were just as upset about the principle, and maybe more upset about the principle, as they were about the word. It wasn't the word Kristallnacht that they were upset about. It was the comparison to the Jews. And it, as you say, the comparison was an apt comparison, that the Jews were the wealthy elite. They were highly disproportionate prior to the National Socialist takeover in Germany. And that analogy holds. But the Jews, it was the Occidental Observer had an article about this too that made a good point that I hadn't thought of before, which is that it's really the Jewish narrative about anti-Semitism is that there is absolutely nothing that the Jews are doing that causes anti-Semitism. It is purely a moral or mental failing in the anti-Semite that causes anti-Semitism. And that's the that is involved in what I said earlier about the way that they invert reality. They sense that a Jew doing harm is – they're more aware of it and more – they see it more quickly than any non-Jew does. And they speak up before non-Jews even get a chance to complain about the harm that Jews are causing. And they sort of preempt that and fill the vacuum instead with, oh, woe is me stories about how it's actually the Jews that are being harmed.
You know, I think too, Tan, that they're very successful in that. And that's what's so sad, that most white people, and I don't know about just saying non-Jewish people, but most white people have been indoctrinated into believing that anti-Semitism is some kind of a hateful thing that has nothing to do with Jewish behavior.
From what I can see, it goes back. It's one of the elements of Jewish identity, and that it goes all the way back in history. If you look back in throughout recorded history of the Jews dealing with their hosts, that this is one of the handful of tactics that they resort to over and over and over again. It's part of the nature of their being parasites.
To invert the causes of things, to invert everything.
Think about it, they're not trying to create a society of their own and for themselves. They are trying to ride on somebody else's backs. Mm-hmm. They are, and that is, they're, you know, infiltrating, manipulating, and exploiting host populations. It's not just white people. It's just for the last 2,000 years, it's been primarily white people. But even going back before that, they were doing it all around the basin of the Mediterranean. They were doing it to the Romans. They did it to the Egyptians. They did it to the Persians, to the Sumerians, to, you know, every civilization going as far back in written history as there's history. The Jews have been doing the same things over and over again.
Yeah, but it's an important point that they really only get away with this stuff where there's already a plutocracy. I mean, that's where they really have a field day, where there are already people.
How about what they did in Russia?
Okay, well, you're talking about after the Bolshevik Revolution?
Well, it would have to be, I guess.
Yeah, well, the Jews ended up not controlling the Soviet Union in the long run.
Yeah, but in a sense they did. In a sense, they were still there.
Yeah, I mean, most of the Bolshevik leaders was Jews, wasn't they?
Yeah.
Even well, Putin said that recently.
Yeah, he did say that, yeah. But we don't want to get off the track into that too much, because I think that what we're getting at here is that we have to do something about educating people about anti-Semitism, how it's used as a to harm us. It's not used in an honest way. People should not be falling for it. Don't you think that that's?
Well, I think in that respect, anti-Semitism is best understood as anti-parasitism. Anti-Semitism, and that encompasses our point of view of it as well as the Jewish point of view of it, that, of course, the parasite thinks that anti-parasitism is bad. And we engage in anti-parasitism because we don't like being parasitized, that we react negatively to the harm that Jews are causing by their manipulation and exploitation of us. And then the Jews see that as anti-Semitism. But all it really is us reacting to the harm that they're causing.
Yeah, parasitism is a really bad word. How do you get people to accept that? I mean, then they'll say, oh, that's so awful to call these people parasites. That's really anti-Semitic.
I'm more worried that we are being too reactionary, that we are being too tit-for-tat as far as constantly being behind, one step behind the Jews. The Jews always have the initiative. They're always the ones striking, and then we're the ones who are reacting to what they're doing. And that if there's ever going to be a solution to the Jewish problem, it's going to involve getting out in front of the Jews, anticipating and being on the offensive rather than reacting.
Well, right.
So, you know, seeing them as parasites helps. I mean, they don't shy away from calling anti-Semites viral, diseased. They use the most dehumanizing language that they can imagine to describe anti-Semitism and anti-Semites. So there really should be no hesitation to think in the same terms, at the very least, about what they're doing. As I pointed out before, that the word virulent, for instance, they always say virulent anti-Semitism, virulent anti-Semitism. If you look up what virulence means, virulence is a measure of the harm caused by parasites. You could say Americans are a lot of things, and white people are really a lot of things, but white people are not parasites.
Mm-hmm. Didn't know virulence is a
it's a biological term. Parasites. Yeah. The technical meaning of virulence is it's a description of the harm that's actually caused by parasitism.
Yeah, I recall you saying that now, I think, on one of your programs.
Well, you know, another way to look at Perkins' letter is that he's saying that he, as a Gentile plutocrat, has many things in common with the Jews.
Yes.
That's what he's saying.
He was making a sympathetic statement. He was being sympathetic to the Jews. He was trying to say, I understand what the Jews have been saying all these years about Kristallnacht and oppression. And I feel so sympathetic to them that I feel like I'm one of them, essentially. Yeah. He was married to a woman who was Danielle Steele, who was half-Jewish, at least half-Jewish.
Yeah,
so that might be part of it.
You add Hitlerum, and it's cheap rhetoric, but in a way, it's also very true, because without these money grubbing white people that don't give a shit, they just don't give a damn about other white people. The Jews couldn't do anything.
Hadding, your sound is a little bit too loud.
All right, well,
You wanted me to tell you about that. And on a different program.
About 18 inches away from the microphone.
Well, I still hear you fine. Okay.
This is why connected to the word anti-Semite. That's why I think this mantra that's come out, the anti-race is just a code word for anti-white. That's why I think that's so good, because that kind of blunts the spear. Because usually, if any white people especially, speak up for their own interests, they just get shouted down as a racist. So when people have that kind of answer, to kind of deflect it. That seems to be doing quite good. It's spreading all over the place. So I think it's a bit of a similar thing with anti-Semitism, quote unquote. People need to realise that that term, it's not used defensively to protect Jews or anyone. It's actually used to attack you, you know, white man, white woman. They're calling you anti-Semite, so you can't criticise them about anything. So we have to get it through to people somehow that it's just a word to basically attack us.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's them setting themselves apart and above everyone else. They have a special word for racism as applied to them, and they call it anti-Semitism.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and you know, the problem, white people tend to be universalistic. They tend to think that they have to create a worldview in which everyone is welcome, no one is discriminated against. And this is not just, we have sort of an innate genetic reason for doing that, but it's also hyped by the Jews. The Jews' media propaganda and educational propaganda encourages that kind of behavior in us. And you can see it in this Perkins thing. They're actually punishing him or excoriating him for being too willing to do that. That's really the trap that Tom Perkins fell into, was trying to universalize this message that the Jews were indoctrinating everyone with, is about the Holocaust narrative, the Kristallnacht narrative, is to protect minorities, that minorities have to be protected from majorities. But no, the real message there coming from the Jews is particularist. It is that the Jews in particular need to be protected. It's not a general message when the Jews tell it. They want it to be understood as a general message, and that's how it gains acceptance amongst white people. And part of the reason why white people, I think, respond pretty positively to that anti-racist as a code word for anti-white is because it provides the baby step for them from the universalist mindset toward particularism, toward a white particularism, that they can take that step toward pro-white by being first morally outraged that, hey, wait a minute, yeah, these people who are claiming to be anti-racist, they're not really anti-racist in the sense that racism is a generic thing. They're actually just criticizing white people. And it strikes a chord with them because they have all their lives been thinking in universalist terms, that racism is a universal problem. And they don't realize that, no, racism, in reality, if you pay close attention, is really criticisms of racism are only aimed at white people.
That's it. And you never hear the Jews say, you know, those Chinese anti-Semites or those black anti-Semites. Well, not much. It's 95% of the time it's always against us, isn't it?
You know, Paul, I hear you fine, but your voice, your sound level is not showing up like it's quite loud enough. So try to talk louder so everybody can hear you. I'm busy watching the sound, which I usually can't do.
I think they do. The Jews do complain about anti-Semitism in non-whites, but I think they aim it at the non-whites. They're concerned and they put it in the media that's aimed at those non-whites. So we white people, we hear the complaints about anti-Semitism that are aimed at whites because that's the media that we're paying attention to. It's targeted, in other words. But, you know, we're all just goyim from the Jewish point of view. We're all, they have a saying, even a philo-Semite is just an anti-Semite who doesn't know it yet. We're, you know, they're walking around in a world surrounded by anti-Semites and potential anti-Semites. That's how they see it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is the big question for today. I think this is the big problem to be solved. I can't quite get away from this subject. This that they keep bringing up now. They're constantly bringing it up and wanting. I would say they. I mean Jews. Organized Jewish groups all over are wanting laws to be passed in Europe now that where they're not, and they were complaining that there are still some countries that don't that haven't criminalized anti-Semitism or made it against the law, still haven't passed laws against anti-Semitism, and they named off all these countries, and I recall Austria was number one. So there are a lot of countries that you would think, but they haven't passed laws against anti-Semitism, and this is what they want now. So, you know, they're going full steam ahead at this, and it needs to be met, and people need to understand what, you know, with the way I see it, that Jews are always trying to get resolutions passed. And they get, like, congresses and parliaments and so on to pass a resolution that they like because it doesn't have any legal binding. And so the members of parliament or the congressman or whatever say, well, you know, okay, I can go ahead and vote for this. It just makes the Jews happy. And then they take all these resolutions and they try to eventually turn them into laws by constantly talking about how we passed this and they passed that and they say this and believe this. And that's another tactic that they have, that they just keep building up toward where they can pass an actual law. And once they get a law passed, boy, then they really go after enforcing it as much as possible with all their huge number of legal teams. Well, we're at 60 seconds, so we're going to be going to the break. And then there's a little story, a little bit about Gilad Atzmon to talk about when we come back, and some other things. So be thinking about what it is you want to bring up in the second hour, folks, on the show here. All right. And I know, I think you have some things that aren't about the Jews that you'd like to bring up. So we'll get into that after we do a little bit more Jew talk, after we come back from the break. And, so, ladies and gentlemen, I'm a little early with this. We've still got 10 seconds. But let's see. The break music is the German swing music, which I still haven't changed, but it's very pleasant. Go ahead. Back to 5. Oh, Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager with the Heretics Hour on February 3rd, 2014, and I'm here with the whole crew from the White Network, Tan Stoffel, Padding, and Paul. And we've been talking about mainly about how the charge of anti-Semitism is so dangerous to us and how it's used and misused by organized Jewish groups. And just I'll stop there. And I'm going to say that instead of going right into Gilad Atzmon, I want to do my little thing here on economics, very short. Just as a good example of more harm that Jews do to we white people in our nations, and that's a little bit about the Federal Reserve, which people know pretty well everything to know about it. But you know, it was charged with the mission, among other things, of making sure that we have a stable currency in this country, and the fact is that. When that was done in 1913, there was little doubt that they could accomplish that, because consumer prices in the United States had been more or less stable since the founding of the Republic. There had been periods of rising prices, such as the war between the states, and periods of falling prices, such as the last quarter of the 19th century, this person says, but consumer price inflation never developed a real purchase or a real, you know, really didn't become anything in the U.S. until the Federal Reserve was set up to prevent it. Think about that. And that's basically, you know, I suppose, economists could say, well, what about this? What about that? And they could try to make it more complex. But basically, it's as simple as that. And so this is something that they've done to us, and the American people should be pointed out to the American people. But as this is where I've got where I think we're not able to reach them, because the mainstream media is telling them other things. So about Gilad Atzmon, since nobody had anything more to say about that. Well, that's pretty well clear. Let me find out where that is. You know, he's a nice enough guy. But here in this recent blog he wrote for Holocaust, that January 29th Holocaust Commemoration Day, he said that maybe the time was ripe for a Jewish apology. And he ended it by saying that that instead of constantly blaming the Goyim for inflicting pain on Jews, it is time for Jews to look in the mirror and try to identify what is in Jews in their culture that evokes so much fury. It may even be a good time for Jews to apologize to the Gentiles around them for evoking all this anger. Well, you know, he says that, but, you know, is that enough to say? You know, is that enough to say, I guess, is my question. And then he says, I would willingly take this opportunity to make an apology, but I have not been a Jew for a while now. Well, the last I recalled, he was saying he was a Jew again, and he was talking as a Jew. Because a long time ago, I thought he had said he was not a Jew anymore. But I guess I was mistaken, because now he's again saying that he hasn't been a Jew for a long time. So, what is he?
I thought that as well, Carolyn, because the first thing I noticed when I went on his website was at the top, on the tab, he's got, I think it's called the Kaaba. You know, that Muslim big black stone that they all go around every year. That sort kind of sacred stone in Saudi Arabia. So I was wondering if he'd turn Muslim, but I couldn't see any evidence of that.
He's got what up there?
You know, every year, well, once in their life, Muslims are supposed to go to Saudi Arabia, to Mecca.
Yeah, but I don't see that there. I don't see that.
Yeah, I can't remember what they call that, but at the top of his site, where you've got the tab, there's a picture of it. It's like a black square.
Okay.
Well, that's strange, but I did read through the article that you mentioned, and I think it's quite sinister, because everything in the article you can more or less agree with, apart from one paragraph, and that paragraph, he says, Zionism was destined to crash. In spite of being driven by anti-Jewish sentiments, Zionism was quickly defeated by a vile chauvinist amplification of every possible crude Jewish symptom it was initially supposed to eradicate. Now, in what way was Zionism, when it first started, driven by anti-Jewish sentiments? I don't get that. How is having a Jewish state and being sort of putting Jews first, how is that anti-Jewish sentiment?
Well, let me try and explain. Gilad Otzman is a typical diasporist assimilationist Jew, as opposed to the Zionist Jew. He doesn't seem to understand, or he is deliberately misunderstanding what the Jews are and what the problem is. But he doesn't know enough to spout the standard Jewish narrative about Zionism, why the Jews needed Israel. The standard narrative goes is because Europeans have oppressed them for all this 2,000 years. And so they need a state of their own in which to be themselves and to be protected from the anti-Semites. That's the standard line that he's he's agreeing with there.
Transparently false.
Yeah, because it started with sort of killing the Palestinians, didn't it? And saying, you know, get off this land or you're going to get a bullet.
It's based on the premise that Jews can do no wrong. The Jews didn't do anything wrong to cause the anti-Semitism of the Europeans, and they didn't do anything wrong in pushing Palestinians off of the land to create Israel. Because
The other point is they didn't have to go to Palestine to have a homeland. They had other options.
Yeah, but that was the one that they, you know, fits their history of themselves as they see it.
Chaim Weizmann was hell bent that the Jews would settle in Palestine or nowhere.
Right. So that all fits there. They have to have their own story, you know, and they have to be able to do it the way they want to do it, and they manage to do that. They can always find the white man who will sympathize with them or something, and or be afraid of them or whatever, and will go along with them. They never fail in that. I suppose because they are so determined. Go ahead.
It seems to me a bit like, you know, these truth tellers like Alex Jones, David Icke, that most of what they say, or a lot of what they say, is true, but then they'll always put in that certain part to kind of throw you off the trail. And that's what that paragraph is to me. You know, he'll say a lot that you can agree with, and then he'll put something like that in. And I know a fair amount of white nationalists support him and sort of copy and paste his articles. But on Wiki it says about him, Atzman's activism has included conducting Socialist Workers' Party musical fundraisers. Socialist Worker Party is allied to the Anti-Nazi League and the Respect Party, which is a British Muslim party fronted by George Galloway. So, I mean, you know, he's not one of us, which...
He's very anti-Nazi, and so is Paul Eisen, seem to be kind of hand-in-hand, those two.
Apparently David Duke and Kevin MacDonald endorse Atzman. That's on the Wiki as well, but
I know they do, and a lot of people endorse Paul Eisen, too, because he sounds so friendly, and he criticizes Israel. And they criticize, they say they're Holocaust deniers, but up to a point, you know, and so on. But, you know, this Zionism was destined to crash. I think that was true. I was reading something, I don't think I have it here in these notes, but I was reading something recently. And it was like the guy who was the father of Zionism, what's his name, Hattie? Herzl. Herzl was, you know, he's he's the one that set up that, you know, set up the whole thing about Zionism. We have to have this homeland and so on. That will solve the Jewish problem. That will solve everybody's problem with Jews in their country. And we'll all go to our own homeland, and we'll all, it'll all be different then. We'll have our own nation, and we won't be bothering other people. Well, of course, that was never intended. Couldn't have ever been intended. And I don't know if Zionism was destined to crash, but it wasn't ever going to work. Because the Jews, diaspora Jews, were never going to go there. And nobody ever really, after the first romantic ideas about it or whatever, ever expected them to. Nor are they expected to go there now.
That's right. You know, so the flaw or the problem with Gilad Atzmon and the white nationalists who look at his criticism of Jews, criticism of Israel, and that's all they hear. They don't dig any deeper. They don't think about why, what is he saying and why is he saying it, is he's coming at it from an anti-racist point of view. He's coming at it from an anti-Nazi point of view. He wants the everyone else's countries to be open for the Jews to live in, like himself. He wants to live amongst the Goyim. And he thinks, if you read his criticism of the Israelis, he's saying that they are making Jews look bad to the Goyim, and that they need, that's why he's saying that they need to apologize. But what he is himself is an apologist for Jews. And that might sound silly.
Yes,
that
so is Paul Eisen.
Yes, and most of these Jews who pose as critics of Jews and seem to be critics of Jews are really, in a sense, apologizing for the Jews, not in the sense of saying sorry, but they're making excuses for the Jews, and they're worried. His concern here, and he puts it, let me read what he actually says. Seemingly, Jewish organizations around the world are scared by the recent developments in France. Once again, they clearly failed to appreciate the growing mass fatigue of Shoah indoctrination. Well, what he's really saying there is that he sees that the Jews are afraid, but he's afraid too, that people are getting tired of the Jews, and they're getting wise to the Jews, and so the Jews need to turn it down a little bit. And he himself, even though he says he can't apologize, he excuses himself from having to apologize because he's not a Jew, he pretends, that he thinks that the other Jews should apologize. It reminds me of that saying that they have about a Zionist is a Jew who's willing to pay another Jew to live in Israel. Or something. It's there's a little element to that here to Gilad Atzmon too. He wants the other Jews to apologize for the, and he doesn't say it's harm that they need to apologize. He seems to accept the Jewish narrative that they're the ones who have been harmed. The only thing that he adds to that is that he thinks that they're harmed because they're so rude or whatever. He doesn't seem to understand that rudeness is an inherent part of what a Jew is, that it has nothing to do with their religion. It's inborn, and it's how they do what they do. It's how they get their way, by being abusive and pushy and rude. Mm-hmm. And that inevitably causes conflict with the peoples that they want to live amongst. But he himself is a good example of that. He wants a deracinated host to live amongst. That's his ideal living environment. And what he's doing is just trying to create that. He's a different type of Jew, going about it in a different way, whereas other Jews are more pushy and overt, and they put a cap on their head, and they wear a Jewish star and clearly identify themselves. He plays this game of, I'm not really a Jew anymore. I've decided I'm not going to be a Jew, as if it's something that can be decided like that.
Well, yeah, and so Paul, you're right in that they're anti-racist. And Paul Eisen is, I would say these two men and others like them are gatekeepers, for trying to keep the heat off the Jews. They have some sincerity, I suppose. But they're humanists. And so that's why they're not good for the whites. And
I think people with, these, characters, like Atzmon, people have to look at the whole thing they're saying, everything they're saying, instead of thinking, well, oh, that's good. I like what he's saying there. So mm-hmm. I'll use his articles and I'll link to him on my website and things like that. I think that's a mistake. And as you say, gatekeeper, that's probably what he's there for.
You know, well, whether he's there for that or he put himself or he just fulfills that purpose, I don't know that he's been put there, but that's the purpose he fulfills. But yeah, and this is the same thing where people say, well, he says some good things. I hate that. I really hate that. I mean, that's so prevalent. Well, I like some of the things he says. I see him as a friend. You know, you can't expect 100% perfection from people. Well, you do have to expect, I think if we're going to get out of this mess we're in, you do have to expect that people understand what the issues are and that they're 100% for the white, our white agenda or whatever. And you can't just let people in or look up to people who are only partially there. Yeah.
There's a bit of a Brother Nathaniel type thing going on here, too, that the white people who look at figures like this are in part attracted to them because they're Jews and because they can in a way they can hide behind that and see, I'm not really a Jew hater. I'm just saying things that this Jew has said. See, even the Jews say these things about the Jews. So there's that element to it, too. Instead of standing on their own feet with their own identity about who they are and what group they belong to, they point to these Jews as spokesmen. They look to Jews to do the dirty work.
That's the only way it can be valid, kind of thing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, can we talk about Woody Allen for just a little bit? In the same vein here of... I suppose of getting away with, I think in terms of Roman Polanski, and I didn't look to think of others. We know there's a lot of sexual abuse going on amongst Jews. I mean, it's in the news a lot. But these Hollywood stars, you know, and these big names that we find engaging in this kind of thing, and you might say. Well, we don't know that Woody Allen is guilty of this. It has never been proven. That's true. We don't, but my sense is that he is. Sorry, that's my sense. So, what do you think, Patty? Oh, go ahead, Pam.
Well, the woman he's married to is a former adoptee, too. So it seems like he tried with some of the early adoptees, and it didn't work out. And finally, he got an adoptee that went along with the program, and now he's married to her.
I think that's a real important aspect of it, that, you know, after that business, and he and Mia Farrow separated, and then I guess I've read that this wife of his was his adopted daughter, but that might be a mistake because mostly I read that she was Mia Farrow's adopted daughter. Not they don't say she was his adopted daughter. Somewhere it said that she wasn't.
What happened was it was her former partner. They adopted that Oriental girl, Soon Yi. And then when she split with the former partner and got with Woody Allen, he kind of became her stepdad kind of thing.
I see. Well, thank you, Paul, for that. I really couldn't get that clear. Well, who was the former partner then? Was that the Previn guy? Andre Previn. Yeah, because her name is Previn. All right. So that's pretty strange that he wants to get romantically attached to these children in his family, even if they are adopted and not, you know, directly, they're not his children. I think that's pretty telling. So do you think so, Tan?
My reaction to Woody Allen is that this isn't even in the same league as Jonathan Pollard or the other thing, Tom Perkins and these other things, because it's really just social degeneracy. This wouldn't be happening if the Jews weren't in control. I think one of the interesting things about the story is that the Jews haven't yet circled the wagons around Woody Allen. And I think that's in part because he married out, because he did go with this Oriental woman, and because he's often characterized as a self-hating Jew, sort of like Gilad Atzmon, that he has criticized in the past more Zionist Jews and Israel. Although when I searched for signs of them circling the wagons around him to defend him from anti-Semitism. What I actually found was a story from this past fall that Woody Allen made an offhand remark about most of the criticism of Israel. It's in line with what you said at the beginning about Abe Foxman saying that most of the criticism of Israel is really just veiled anti-Semitism. And the reason that that got publicized in the news is because Woody Allen himself has been critical of Israel in the past and has this reputation as a critic of Israel, a self-hating Jew. But I think it's mainly the fact, I would explain the lack of them circling wagons around him so far, is that he hasn't been attacked explicitly as a Jew yet, and the fact that he's married out, that he's really kind of betrayed the tribe, so the tribe isn't going to necessarily circle the wagons around him like they have around Roman Polanski. Roman Polanski's a good analogy to the situation, except for the fact that with Roman Polanski, they did circle the wagons around him when he was arrested a few years ago, temporarily detained, I should say, for the absconding from court 20, 30 years ago. There was a great outcry amongst the Jews. It reminded me of the Tom Perkins thing. It reminded me of, and the Jews, it reminds of Pollard. It reminds of all of their other scapegoats, what they call the scapegoats, the blood libel, the Jew unfairly accused. And I'm surprised that that hasn't come out yet with Woody Allen, that they haven't made a bigger stink about Woody Allen being unfairly persecuted here because he's a Jew. It may happen yet, but I haven't seen any signs
of it. Yeah, well, maybe since they can't prosecute him, if they could prosecute him, they probably would circle the wagons around him. But, you know, I do want to say that I was struck because he says he's 78 now, and I was struck at these recent pictures how much he looks like Elie Wiesel. He looks, they don't really actually look alike, but they look very similar. They have that same droopy old look and face and nose and that flyaway gray hair and so on. I thought there was a strong similarity between these two.
Family
groups.
Resemblance. It's genetic.
That's right.
Well, literally, it's, you know, on average, any two Ashkenazi Jews are something like fifth cousins.
Yeah,
well, very closely related.
When you say he's a self-hating Jew like Atzmon, he does differ on Israel from Atzmon, doesn't he?
Oh, because I think he's less harsh about it than Atzmon is, yeah.
Says, I support Israel and I've supported it since the day it was founded. Israel's neighbors have treated it badly, cruelly, instead of embracing it and making it part of the Middle East family of nations. And
yeah.
He goes on and on.
But even the mildest criticism of Israel by a Jew is enough to get the other Jews calling them self-hating, to get a reputation amongst Jews. Their standard as to what is acceptable for Jews to say about Jews is very strict.
Yeah, I recall that Woody Allen even gets some criticism in Alan Bloom's The Closing of the American Mind for being a Jew that didn't seem to put any value on Jewishness.
Yeah.
Well, did you want to say anything more about Woody Allen, Hattie, before
no.
we move on? No.
No.
Okay,
one thing I'd say to point out that the girl who's accusing him of the abuse, that's actually Mia Farrow's biological daughter, isn't it?
No.
Isn't it?
They've got all these adopted kids.
I'm not sure. I think it is, you know. Dylan Farrow, her name is.
Yeah, I know, because that's her
they take the
Mia
name.
Farrow adopted her. And, you know, I've read that both of them that Mia Farrow, she's her adopted daughter, but she was adopted by both of them. But maybe when they split up, he was not allowed to have anything to do with her anymore, and so maybe that means he's no longer her adopted father or something like that. But
they've just got the son then, who is apparently.
Yeah, and that's not, you know, that's. You know, that son, that's another interesting thing. What's his name?
Ronan
Farrow. he's sticking up for his with his sticking with his sister and mom, but they say he might be Frank Sinatra's son. He absolutely is Frank Sinatra's son.
Yeah.
He looks like him. Doesn't look anything like Woody Allen. I mean, he looks his eyes. I've seen pictures of him where his eyes are just a dead ringer for you know, old blue eyes, Frank Sinatra. And so I think that's interesting that they still pretend like he might be Woody Allen's son.
Well, I just want to say that Woody Allen's film Zelig,
yeah,
is a great caricature of Jewishness, because it has scenes in there where they see Zelig supposedly has this weird syndrome about him. They say you put him with fat men and he suddenly becomes bloated. You put him with Negroes and he suddenly begins to look like a Negro, and you know, it's like the Jewish chameleon. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, his films are interesting. I don't know what this latest one, Blue Gardenia or whatever it is about at all. But I'm kind of interested in him again now from all this.
That's part of the purpose, probably, of this whole thing is a publicity stunt.
Well, I don't know. I think it'd be kind of strange if I'm getting into all this stuff, but you know, I do think that it matters if this film gets Academy Awards at this point, because since this daughter, this adopted daughter, has brought this up at this time, and I don't blame her for bringing it up at this time, because she's probably thinking, you know, nobody listens to me, and he's still getting all this attention and all this applause and so on, and so I'm going to say something right now and see if there's any reaction to it from Hollywood, because Hollywood doesn't seem to care. And I think it would look kind of bad if Hollywood votes for him to get Academy Awards for this film. It's not just about films, you know. Has to be about the person too. So it's
yeah. One of the things about it was she didn't put the message on her own personal blog. She didn't tweet it. She actually got a column. I think it was
right.
Nicholas Kristof.
Yeah,
I assume
he's
as a Jew.
Too. Yeah.
He publicized it for her. He gave her the soapbox to stand on to make this announcement.
Right. I thought that was because he's Jewish, but I guess he maybe not any fan of Woody Allen or something. So somebody else started to say something. Was it you, Hattie?
Well, I think Woody Allen's just a weird Jew, you know, needs his hand slapped or something.
Okay. Now, Paul, did you want to bring up a couple of things?
yep. I'd like to bring up the subject of parades and cultural events amongst white people. I don't know if you've heard of St. George's Day, but it's one of the few kind of English events that we've still got. There's a lot of kind of more obscure ones that have faded away, regional ones and stuff you could find. But the only one really left, which is English at all, is St. George's Day. So that was, I went to the parade, I think it was in 2005, and it was the only time I've ever saw thousands and thousands, unless you're talking about a football match, thousands and thousands of white people all waving a national flag. And you'll have knights on horses and bands and all this kind of thing, but it caused controversy. So let me just read a bit of an article from 2009 in a local paper. The title is "Council Approach Plays Into Hands of Far Right." West Brom St George's Day Parade is the biggest in the country, attracting 15,000 revellers from across Birmingham and the Black Country who want to peacefully celebrate their Englishness. Why then does Sandwell Council seem hell-bent on destroying it? This year's march is due to take place on April the 19th between Stonecross and Dartmouth Park, but organisers fear the local authority has been deliberately dragging its feet. As a result, the deadline for applying for road closures has already passed, leaving the whole event in limbo. Organiser Jeff Collins fears the dead hand of political correctness. Sandwell is more than happy to make a big show of the Wally or St. Patrick's Day parade, he said, and I have no problem with that. But it seems the one event they aren't comfortable with is England's National Day. Now, basically, they did everything they could to destroy this parade because it was a, quote, monocultural. It also made the national papers, Axe Falls on St. George Parade, it says, is halted after council says it attracts racist fucks. England's biggest St. George's Day parade is facing the axe after councillors said many of those attending it were racist. For the last decade, up to 15,000 people have assembled in West Bromwich under the slogan Forever England. So basically, they did everything they could, used all the red tape they could and all these little laws, and in the end, it kind of got destroyed. They took away the £10,000 funding, so that's a measly £10,000 when you get a lot more spent on, you know, black events and Indian events.
Yeah.
Now, this, in a way, ties into Northern Ireland. And I say that because John Tyndall said in the 11th hour, in Ulster, liberalism does not yet dominate her institutions, nor her education system, nor her church, nor her people. And he asked why. Because Ulster is one of the few white countries, certainly in Western Europe, that has kept its culture and traditions. Because in the Baltic, you've got this, they do these singing things where thousands of people will be in a big stadium singing patriotic songs. But you've not got that anywhere in Western Europe, really. Now, these things about the parades in Northern Ireland, if anybody goes on YouTube and puts Ulster parades, I think you'll be impressed by the way it is. You've got thousands and thousands of white people, and you've got all these bands, the drums, the flutes. And the good thing about it is blacks and Asians can't say, you know, I want to be involved. You know, they won't say that because we know they don't want to. They don't want to celebrate St. George's Day. They don't want to celebrate Ulster parades, which are marking important dates in their history. But one thing which is missing from the English parade, because somebody asked me, they says, what was it like? I said it was good, but it was a bit quiet. There wasn't enough music and stuff. Because the Scots, they've got their bagpipes, and the Northern Ireland have got the drums. They've got their own drum called the Lambeg, which is really loud. And if you have a few of them together, that makes a real impression. So I think that's a problem we've got. I mean, it's like that Jimmy Marr used his bagpipes, and he's been in a lot of papers and stuff with his mantra work. And the two good things about using music is, number one, it attracts interest. Just in general, you know, people come over, what's going on? Number two, it's uniquely European to play certain types of music, like bagpipes or drums. I noticed Haddin plays the banjo a bit, and that's another good thing. Because I think in America, you're the same as Britain in a way, that you've lost these kind of cultural things, but there are little pockets, such as the Appalachian Mountains. And I've saw in Appalachia, they're very much into the banjo, and they're into clogging. They have these clogging festivals every year, where all ages do the clogging. And you can see how it's kind of related to Ireland. And the Dutch also do this kind of clogging thing, and have festivals. So don't you think it's funny how that film Deliverance really attacked the Appalachia people? I think that was on purpose because they don't like us having these kind of cultural things because they're not quote unquote inclusive. Well, they're not inclusive because there are things. We should have our own things. We should be proud of our things. And don't you think it's even funny more that John Voight starred in that film, Deliverance, and he's a hardcore Zionist. I don't know if you don't know that, but if you search for John Voight on YouTube and see what he says about Israel and Zionism, it will make you sick. There's videos of him crying about the Jews and how bad they're treated by the Arabs. So I just wanted to bring that up, really, and mention that NSDAP made a lot of good use of marching with music and stuff. recently, I listened to your interview with you, Tan, and Tom Metzger, and I've heard him say he's against marching because it attracts the Reds. The Reds all counter demonstrate, and then there's violence, and we always get the blame. That's true in a way, because if you have a load of skinheads marching or in Nazi uniforms, it doesn't really achieve anything. But there's a different kind of marches. If you have a march which is cultural, with the, you know, family, all ages, you know, cultural clothes, like, you know, Scottish kilts or whatever, that kind of thing, it's much harder for the Marxists and the liberals to say, you're racist, you know, you're marching because you're racist. Look at you, saw white people, there's no black people there. You can say, so what, there's no black people there. They have their carnivals, they have their thing. This is our thing. So I just wanted to bring that up, really.
Well, I think that's real good, Paul. You know, it makes me think of this white man's march that the people at Renegade are trying to organize. I don't know how that's going to come off, but you're saying that we should be trying to organize cultural events and on a large scale. And you know what I think the problem that it isn't done is because it takes a heck of a lot of work. It takes a lot of organization. And it is, now in cities you could do it. It is easier to organize things, I think, in Britain, particularly like in England or wherever they want to do it, than it is here, because they generally want to draw people from all over the country, and that gets to be a real problem, you know, for all that transportation. But if it could be in a local thing in a local area, then you have to get enough people to do it. But there's very few people, hardly anybody anymore, who is willing to take on a big project of that nature, you know?
I think the closest thing you've got to it is Columbus Day, isn't it? And I've noticed the Mexicans don't even like that, and they'll attack that.
No,
that's
right.
Well, you know why? I mean, you've got your festivals in Mexico, haven't you? Cinco de Mayo or whatever. So.
Well, they have that here.
Yeah.
Actually, Cinco de Mayo is not a major holiday in Mexico. It's only a big holiday in the United States.
That's right.
Yeah, and I think that they understand, or their organizers understand, the power of these cultural events, you see. It's not just going to have fun, although it is fun. It has a lot of impact. But with most sort of Anglo-Saxons, we've lost that link. Well, that link's been severed, you see. And that's why they hate Ulster so much, and they want to destroy Ulster, because they're not letting go to that link. They've had the marches year after year for hundreds of years. And that's one problem we've got, I think.
It is a problem. And when we look at what we should be doing and what we could do, or, you know, that's when we see how I don't know. I don't want to be too negative. Maybe I'm wrong, but. You know, how weak we've become. And I think that it's all this entertainment, cultural stuff that they've got everybody addicted to. That's why these things are, you say they're fun, but they seem so simple and not big enough entertainment for most people today, who would rather just watch a bunch of stuff on their TV. Extravaganzas or something, or go to big sporting events, then attend something like this.
Yeah, that's the Super Bowl is like the cultural event of the year for a lot of people, I suppose.
Yeah, and they don't have to do anything, you know, it's all just presented for them. We really have, do you think we've gotten lazy, Tan? I know you're the one that doesn't like to criticize white people.
I see it as we have human beings, especially white people, have an innate need to express our belonging to a group. And you can see it in the Super Bowl. I see that as an expression of that. It's squeezing out. We want to root for a team. Even as bizarre as it is to root for a bunch of strangers on the television, and how
Negroes.
People. Yeah, but it comes out in the form of political parties too, that we root for either the Reds or the Blues. You know, that identity is inherent. It comes from within us, the need to identify, and it's misdirected into these other things, the local sports team or the political party, rather than being directed in a healthy direction toward our own people, the people who we are most closely related to, and celebrating our expressions of our culture, of our people.
It seems like when we try to do something like that, we can't compete with what the Jewish cultural stuff that's been set up, you know, because there are people who talk about this a lot. We should be celebrating this and that and whatever, you know, in our areas. But we can't compete in drawing people to it because we can't make it exciting enough nowadays.
Well, my feeling about it is that it would be like pissing into the wind anyway to try and organize a march or something and try and fight it that way. I think the way that strikes a chord with me, at least, and I think probably would strike a chord with a lot of other people, is the resentment, the anger that comes from realizing that this has been done, that they attack. Even I'm sure the people in organizing the celebration that Paul was describing aren't racist, would deny that they're racist. But in the same way that anti-white is a code word or anti-racist is a code word for anti-white, racist is just, it means white person. And even when you have just white people, implicitly white, trying to organize an event that turns out to be mostly white, the Jews will identify that as something, a strength of whites or a potential strength of whites, and they've got to destroy it. And so they destroy it. The Tea Party is another good example in the United States of an organization that it's just kind of naive white people who aren't even really thinking about themselves as white people, just doing what white people do. And they are eager to talk about how much they love Martin Luther King and put black people up on the stage to speak to them.
Herman Cain is wonderful!
Exactly. But the liberal media doesn't give them a pass for any of that. The Jews in the media identify them explicitly as white and say that the problem with them is that they're too white. This phrase, too white, is going to become more and more common. That's how they're smashing.
Why do they get away with it? Why do the white people all fall for it?
That's like saying, why does the army that won the battle get away with slaughtering their broken, retreating enemy? That's the state of things right now. Whites are
they
in
have
retreat.
The power. And we need to explain. We need to get it across to the general public, I suppose. I guess that's what David Duke is trying to do. That Jews have all this power, and they're misused.
Well, you know, they don't really have all that much power. I've said this before. The problem isn't the amount of power that Jews have. The problem is there is no resistance. There's very little resistance, and what there is not very organized. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Well, why is there no resistance then?
Because we have an individualist ethos. And we have our so-called leaders preaching this individualism to us, which keeps us crippled.
Okay. All right, is that the bottom line then?
That's my bottom line.
I think the White Man March is a step in the right direction, but maybe something like, European Heritage Day or something like that might have been better, or might be an additional thing where you could have, you know, people could check their ancestry and, you know, I've got Swedish ancestry or I've got German ancestry and come along in their costumes and instruments and stuff like that, you know, just to make the point that we're all European and we're going to get together and we don't care if you call us racist or whatever. That's just your own hatred. So why should we not be able to get together as groups, yet you promote every other group to do that, you know?
Well, you know, I do think it's a problem in the United States, the size of this country and how spread out people are. I can imagine if I were in Germany today, in today's Germany, that it would be a good thing to organize and to promote and to try encourage German cultural events, even though it's true. The government and the powers that be would be against it. They would say, "Oh, you can't. You know, that's not good." That they would be against it. But I think it would. You could have some success with it, or at least it would make sense. But it's hard to. And I think it can be done in Britain. Again, you have everybody against you. But it's very hard in this country, I think. Anybody want to disagree with me on that?
I don't think Germany has those kinds of problems to the extent that we have. There are some things you can't do in Germany, like display a swastika, but, you know, they have, in general, a much stronger sense of being a nation than we have here, and they're not plutocratic the way Britain is, you know. Both Britain and the USA are cursed with plutocracy, which is a negation of nationalism.
Yeah. Well, Germany is discouraging nationalism in every way it can.
But, well, no, not really, because, you know, the Alternative für Deutschland, you know, this new political party is very nationalist, really. In general, they have much more solidarity as a people than either the English, British, or the Americans, the Germans have.
What's wrong with the British, Paul? Why do the British not have, do you think they don't have any solidarity anymore?
Yeah, I think the English in particular have been severely browbeaten, and we have most of the guilt for the British Empire and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Where I've only been to Scotland once, but as soon as I got to Edinburgh, you could hear the bagpipes straight away and all that kind of thing. And I've been to Dublin once, and you can hear their kind of music everywhere and street people playing their music, Irish people playing Irish music. Whereas if you walk through London, you might see some Africans playing some instruments, or you might see some Turks playing some instruments. You won't see anything English like that. So yeah, there is the powers that be do play British people off against each other.
It's really not in the interest of the rich people for there to be a strong national sense of identity, because where you have nationalism, that means the rich are expected to act as if they were members of a community rather than just people who have property rights.
Mm. Yeah, it's a threat, isn't it? The nationalism identity.
It's a threat to plutocracy for sure.
Mm.
Yeah. I could see that. You know, the anniversary of Dresden is coming up. I'm going to have to do something. I'm hoping to get somebody on in particular to talk about it with me, along with some other things. And there's where other things about, other attacks on the British, Paul. And there's where the British are really can be criticized, but they don't mind that. But they are sensitive to being criticized about their empire and what they did to the non-white people. But what they did to white people is not a problem for them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, the British Empire did do a lot of things to sort of help as well, didn't they? Like the railway system in India and this kind of thing, where the Spanish before, they didn't do any of that. The Spanish just took all the gold and enslaved people, and that was that. But all that kind of stuff's left out, and it just suits the liberals and the Marxists and the minorities to bring up the empire to stop any kind of us articulating our sort of wishes. They'll bring that up, you know. They'll say, well, you enslaved their forefathers and all this kind of thing. So you see it all the time, and they'll say you reap what you sow and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah. Well, what about this White Man's March? Anybody following that at all or interested in that? You think? My question is, will they be able to pull anything off? They've raised some money, so maybe they're going to pay. They're going to give, provide some transportation for people to go there.
What the saying as well? If you can't get to one place, sort of do something pro-white on that day, aren't they? Like they're raising money for banners to send out to people. So I might do a banner drop somewhere in England on that day, on the 15th of March. So if you could get about, 50 different things all happening on the 15th of March, that would at least show that we're getting some kind of organisation. You know, if you have different things happening in different states all on the same day, and then people start making videos of it and putting it all together, then that shows we're at least getting organized at last.
I mean, they seem to be putting energy into it. I'm afraid I haven't been reading about it. I'm glad you have. What is the date set for that? April,
15th of March, I believe.
Oh, March. Uh-huh. I was thinking it was... Yeah, coming right up. I've just about gone through everything I had. Who has something they still want to say? We have about 6 minutes left. Come on, host.
I'd like to say something in response to Hadding's point. And going back again to the Tom Perkins thing, that Tom Perkins was right in a sense that there are people out to get the 1%, out to get the plutocrats, but it isn't the Nazis like he thinks it is. It's actually the Jews. And I think that the moral of the story of that the Perkins Purim Fest is that the Jews trump the rich, that the Jews are more cohesive, that they're more powerful than any group of unrelated rich. And it's you saw in that Purim Fest, the Jews, rich and poor, left and right, getting together to smash this plutocrat. The plutocrats really don't have power because they don't act as a cohesive entity. They don't identify with each other.
Right.
So at some point, I think I see a little glimmer of hope in that they will – that this will divide the Jews from the rich, and that they have been collaborating up until this point, and that's part of what has enabled the Jews to take over. But that at this point, the rich are basically enthralled to the Jews, that they go along with the way the Jews want things to go. It's not really the rich that control things. And I'd also like to tie it into the Leo Frank case, which for the last, that's been dominating my mind for the last month and a half,
right,
or 2 months. And that is that it's related to Jonathan Pollard, and it's related to this Tom Perkins thing. It's related to this whole Jewish identity and Jewish mechanism of what they call blood libel, of the Jew wrongly accused, falsely convicted, and wantonly murdered. And, you know, that's how they summarize what happened to Leo Frank. And of course, in digging into the details of the case, you've pretty quickly come to understand that that's entirely wrong on all three points, that Leo Frank wasn't wrongly accused. They actually delayed. They accused several other people before they ever got around to accusing Frank, and they accused him on good evidence, and that he had a lengthy trial in which all of the issues that are raised to this day were all hashed out back then, 100 years ago. He had a fair trial, and then it was overturned, and the people in outrage lynched him and gave him, you know, they executed the sentence that had actually been fairly decided upon already. But the Jews really, they don't waste time trying to go into all the details, really, they sum it up with that simple slogan, that it was two simple words, blood libel, and they do that. They tie it to their longer pattern of narrative of these other people. Alfred Dreyfus is probably the most prominent example of this, the idea that the Jew is wrongly accused of doing wrong, and that it's actually an accusation. They take it as an accusation against Jews in general, and then they come to that Jew's defense as a group.
Yeah, and they provide all kinds of legal help and publicity, you know, in his favor and so on.
The international Jew writers really put their finger on it, that it's almost a measure of Jewish racial character that they do that, that the more money that they spend on a person, that the more important it's seen as reflecting of the Jewish identity and Jewish racial character.
Did, so,
So it all ties together. Go ahead, Paul. But I mean, I just want to make this point that from
everything
we talked about in this program today, it all goes around in a circle together. And 60 seconds. Go ahead, Paul.
I was just going to ask, because I watched a PBS documentary and I didn't know if it's true. Did Henry Ford apologize for his quote-unquote anti-Semitism?
He made this kind of half-hearted. He didn't really apologize, but he said, I don't know, I'd have to get that and quote it, but you know, he said something. But
he went back to his original. But then,
but yeah, he did. I mean, it was known that he wasn't serious about it, but they were really set to destroy his business, and he didn't just have an ordinary little business. You know, he had, I think, the largest industry in the world or of that time or something like that. I mean, it was huge, and it meant a lot to him. He had built it up himself. So he
couldn't fight the Jewish power 100 years ago.
And even they were able to stop him. What a great man he was. Ladies and gentlemen, our show is over. I want to thank my guests, and I hope you enjoyed it. I sure did. Thank you for listening. Good night.
Bye.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com. We'll be right back.